I'd now like to invite all of the presenters up to take some questions. Maybe while we wait for... Well, here we go. So the first one. Should cat modelling be subject... should be a full subject in the actuarial syllabus? Okay?
Yes. definitely. I mean, it's a crucial part of managing risk that... historically, it's not been well covered. In fact, even reinsurance wasn't particularly well covered in the exams historically. It absolutely should be. The world's moving on. The syllabus should update. It should definitely be in there.
It should also be on the syllabus of schools of geography.
One of the questions maybe for you, Ben, that I've got, we talked a lot about the uncertainty in models, and in fact, in that sort of decision tree, there's uncertainties everywhere. The use of the models is maybe more in the interpretation. What are the main mistakes that people make in running cat models?
Good question. I think the most fundamental mistake people make is not to peer review their work. That sounds very, very simple, and I think it's a discipline that actuaries are very, very good at. But a lot of cat modellers have traditionally been rather sketchy on is making sure that all of the data got in. Quite often you'll find that the results have changed because data's been missed, that the G-coding information was typed incorrectly. Similarly, sometimes the models don't capture all of the loss if some coding of risk parameters, whether it be construction type, etc., is incorrect. Now, these seem like really, really simple elemental components that should be correct, but it's never guaranteed that they are correct. And I think a big focus... quite correctly, it started off around the robustness and trustworthiness of results. But more and more, I think we need to be showing exhibits, examples as to the peer reviews that are undertaken to give decision makers comfort that the process has been undertaken correctly.
Yep. One of the questions from the SMS, how good are the cat models at estimating damage for commercial risks? Mike's lucky he can opt out of this one,
yeah.
Given his portfolio.
I would say that they're just as robust as domestic risks, excluding business interruption. Particularly contingent BI is incredibly crude. One of the fundamental flaws in catastrophe modelling, if you think about some of the logic that was shown earlier, I think it was Mark's exhibits, we pretty much look at the amount of damage at a location and apply that across a series of vulnerability curves. So it essentially forces through a relationship between the building, the contents, and the BI components of risks. When we actually look at claims data, quite often you'll see a fish and chip shop that has a huge BI loss because all their stock was defrosted, but very little building damage, whereas the models don't take that into account very well.
Yep. Is anyone in the audience have a question that they either had their phone turned off or didn't want to SMS through? Stand in the front.
Elaine Collins, thank you for that set of presentations. I really had a comment, and it was around Michael's slides. The board needs to understand the residual risk. I was just wanting to emphasise that I think boards need to also understand the gross risk.
Yeah, the gross
risk. Because in the end, the residual risk, you know, you understand the residual risk, but of course the gross risk, the differential is reinsurance recovery is on your balance sheet and that might be there for a long time. So I do think that that is an important aspect for boards to get their heads around too, is the gross risk as well as the residual risk.
Yeah, yes, certainly, yeah. Yeah, it's always interesting, those discussions around setting the top of your program. You know, I think we'd had a question pop up there about, you know, do you see insurers taking different models and then averaging it? I don't think there's really a right answer, but I think if you can, you know, have a set of model outputs that you can overlay some practical experience on, that can help you say, well, yeah, that model actually stacks up a little bit better than the other ones. But yeah, your point about understanding the reinsurance and the program on that underneath that, you know, I think this afternoon they're going to talk about reinsurance, so I probably won't dive into it too much. But yeah, it's certainly a pretty key part of that overall management of natural catastrophe risk.
Maybe a pricing question for you, Jeremy.
Okay.
How would you allow for unmodeled perils in pricing?
I'd build a model.
And then they wouldn't be unmodeled anymore.
Well, I think that question comes from unmodeled being bushfire, flood, storm and hail, and we have built a model for that deliberately, because I think that's the best way to do it. And a model is better than no model. And the thing to do is to validate those models with past data. We've spent a lot of time and effort building a model for unmodeled perils, so we'll have to rename them to other perils or whatever. So definitely build a model.
Well, one of the things we call them at Munich Re is lesser modelled perils.
Yeah.
The other interesting challenge there is trying to get the correlations correct. I mean, if you think about an East Coast low that hits New South Wales, then it will have hail, it will have water, it will have wind. We're very good at building models in isolated little components, but trying to get all of these to work together is a bit of a challenge as well. And there's various ways that we could approach that. There's definitely something to look at when we deal with these more difficult to model perils. They don't perform quite as easily as earthquake and cyclone models that we're match fit on. We've done this for years. So we just need to think a little bit carefully about that.
And leading on from an earlier question for Michael, which I'd actually like to get the opinion of everyone up here. APRA has a real push now around the board being informed and really understanding the differences between models and the risks involved. How do the three of you go about discussing with a board who, let's face it, maybe doesn't have the same level of knowledge about the underlying model, to give them comfort in the decision that they're making?
I think, you know, I think providing an overview of the key elements of the models is something that we've done. Also getting your modelling resource along to actually talk to them, I think, is pretty critical as well. And you can often leverage, on your board, you might have someone who's an engineer, so they mightn't actually have insurance experience, but they've got, experience for, in a phase that, or in a discipline that can then be applied. So if you actually get the person or the team of people, along who actually does your CAP modelling and get them to talk to the board and answer questions, I think that's pretty critical. But look, it's a difficult thing because, I mean, CAP modelling is a skill. And then trying to distill everything that has happened in a model and provide a set of, often boards are always pressing for less and less time, actual face-to-face time. So you've got to get that balance right, and it's not an easy thing to do. And I think it's just something we keep refining.
Ben or Jeremy?
I think it's a good question. Clarity around communication is key. That often boards may assume that because numbers come out of a model, therefore it's the right answer. So I think clarity around where the uncertainties lie, understand the drivers of risk, and back it up with pragmatism, like the realistic disaster scenario. So I think the common sense approach, which I think is fairly natural to us. So we typically would have a view on what the number's going to be prior to actually running the model, because we'll see how the exposures change. So if you've grown in a certain area, you'd expect this to happen, and be able to explain that with different views of that risk. And where they do differ, understand what the difference is, and then it's a risk appetite decision.
Yep. I'll go a slightly different direction. I agree with what the gents have said completely. One of the other pieces that needs to be communicated is the model evaluation never stops. Every day we run these applications, we learn something new about them. And I think in the past there's been a tendency to think that you start here with evaluating a model and you finish here. When in actual fact, we use an onion as the analogy, because every time you take a layer off, you discover something else you want to test and get to the bottom of. At some point, you've got to be a little bit pragmatic and say, well, we've either got enough comfort with a model at the moment, or we need to keep investigating. And once you do get enough comfort, move on to the next challenge. I think the other thing that's slightly unfair as well is that every time a new model comes out, we need to look at our old models given the new experiences and the new lessons, but I don't necessarily think it's right to throw the old models out just because the new toys arrived either.
And I think that's a good point, Ben, that it's not that we say that the model has been evaluated and now it's correct. Yes. It will always evolve with new information. There's a question over here.
There's a microphone.
Oh, there's a microphone here.
Tom Carr, how do you make sure boards understand the uncertainty around all of these things? My experience once with a bank board was that they were told this was how much they could lose from VAR on a market risk model, and they thought that was the maximum they could lose, which was clearly very wrong. So they just don't understand. They want simple answers, but how do you convince them that you're trying to help them, but you're not actually giving them the answer?
I think the point made before about dividing and conquering was quite a good one. Quite often you get one board member who starts to understand this and can be quite a good advocate in some of these discussions as well, to make the wider board understand. The other trend that I think is quite good is seeing some of the boards fragmenting into some subcommittees, such as reinsurance subcommittees, et cetera, that you could have more pointed, longer conversations with.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's about clarity around the communication and the detail, and I'll take Ben's point on board that it's continuous. But it's not just a once a year thing. It's always, there's lots of questions. It's a bottomless pit of detail. And I think you just keep going, keep improving, keep asking questions, and more questions lead to more questions. So it's a continual process.
Yeah, and we've had other, non-modelling experts come along and talk to the board about different events and what can go wrong. I think that, the bad luck thing is I think that's something that's pretty critical. What time of the day does it happen? Did it happen on a Sunday night or a Wednesday morning? Those type of things. So having people that can come along and just talk about some of those issues that can arise and kind of continue to kind of keep pressing that point, I think helps breaks down that kind of assumption that models are right.
I think, Tom, maybe another thing for your question is maybe we need to change the way we communicate to boards. I mean, in the past it was very much, and we're delivering you an answer, whether it's the value at risk or whether it's the return period off the OEP curve. Maybe it's about saying that is an answer, but what we think could happen, the worst case is something different. And maybe if we go down more of a path of ranges to actually show people that actually the 1 in 200 is this, but the 1 in 210 is a lot worse than that would help. The question over here.
Can you hear? Yep. It seems to me one of the discussions we have a bit with the board, and it flows from the data and the assumptions. Actually, the data you need, the granularity you need of the data, is different for perils and at different return periods. And as you go further, kind of up the or down the frequency scale, the data becomes less useful in improving the predictability or the uncertainty around the modelling, and yet it's often disproportionately weighted in the board discussions. We've got new data, we know where every risk is located, we still don't know what the vulnerability curve is going to be like. It doesn't improve that much. What's your kind of view or response to that when we're talking about the top of the tower that you're going to purchase?
Again, I'd go back to the point that understanding the data from an underwriting perspective is probably more important than worrying about it from your capital requirement perspective. So therefore, I think there's a lot of other spin-offs that come from having that data that if you hadn't collected it, would be more dangerous.
But it doesn't improve the top at all.
And I think I'd be a little bit careful communicating to the board that the top is the area that's going to be impacted by that information rather than other parts of the distribution. Trying to model flood, bushfire, et cetera, without that data is not impossible.
Any other questions?
That's a valid point. Different perils, and Will demonstrated quite clearly at the beginning, different perils impact different things. And I think for earthquake, where the data's sparse, you have very little choice but to use a model because that's the best that we've got. Lower down, there is experience. The ICA data gives us a good view on that kind of thing, but that can vary by client depending on their pricing. So as an actuary, I always do experience and exposure rating as far as I can, even if sometimes I don't think it's necessarily telling me something, it's telling me something different, it's challenging, it's validation. So I use as much data as possible, and it's a continual process, always improve. If a loss happens, you get bigger than your market share, why is that? What are we doing that someone else isn't doing, or vice versa? So, use it all.
Any other questions? While people are thinking, one of the questions here is, exposure-based models don't always work well for high-frequency, low-severity losses. Burning cost results will vary depending on the recent losses. How can we improve the quantification of the low-level losses?
Two answers again. Firstly, build a model as best you can with the available data for all the perils that is updated, reflecting current data, and use that current data as experience rating too, and validate it against your own actual experience. So it's a sort of three-pronged attack.
Yeah, I think that own experience, I mean, if you've got high frequency losses, you're going to have a fair bit of experience in in kind of managing those and what your assumptions were going into those events and what how did your portfolio stack up. So being able to get those learnings and then feed it back into your process, I think is you know, something you can do to improve that.
No, I'd agree with you, James.
Yep. Other questions or people are keen for lunch? As we're just on time. One last question before we go. No, everyone's very keen for lunch. Well, would you please join me in thanking the presenters.